I'm Jean Harper, and I'm a writer. I live in Northeast Indiana. We live on a horse farm, and my new book is Still Life with Horses, which was published by Howling Bird Press in fall of 2017.
I'm going to have you start by talking about the impetus for Still Life with Horses, the life journey that led you to this particular creative work.
I started writing Still Life with Horses almost, and this is spoiler alert, almost immediately after my horse died, unexpectedly. I had a little notebook with me. I always have a little notebook with me, and I started just jotting down memories and images and things like that because that's what I do for life. That's how I understand things. And then gradually, I began to realize that there was at least an essay in this experience, and then the essay appeared, and then I realized, maybe there's a book in this. So over the course of, I don't know, maybe a couple of years, I drafted the book and then revised and revised and revised the way we do and sent it out a lot of times and got it back a lot of times and kept revising. And then finally, it was picked up by Howling Bird Press and won their nonfiction award in 2017.
And it's a story about a horse, but the horse is really a vehicle for a healing journey for your own life and some of the things that you were experiencing at that time. Are you willing to talk about that kind of background a little bit to give our listeners like a little tease about what they might expect to find inside the book?
Sure, absolutely, yeah. The book is definitely about my horse that I just adored. I came to horseback riding late in life or later in life. I was about 40 when I started. And I picked up horseback riding by way of mentoring a middle school girl who was just crazy about horses. And I took her to horseback riding lessons every Saturday for years and years and years. And finally, she was like, well, why don't you ride? And so that I did. And at the same time that all of this was happening, that I was mentoring this little girl who was growing up and, you know, becoming a pretty cool kid and watching her ride and I started to ride, I was also in the middle of a marriage that just wasn't going very well and I was kind of stuck and I really didn't see any way out of it. But the more I spent time with horses, especially my horse, the more I gained a kind of self-confidence and courage in a way and a sense of self that I hadn't had before. And this is something I've noticed that happens to a lot of women who work with horses, that it's an experience that transforms you physically, but it also transforms you emotionally too. You learn how to be just really calm in the presence of an animal whose first instinct when he's upset is to run away. And so, you know, the fight or flight, mostly flight. And so you learn how to be really just kind of centered and calm with this huge animal. And then it's a feedback loop and the animal, you know, starts to look at you as a leader. And so when you become the leader of a 1,000-pound animal, that's really empowering. And that happened to me working with this horse buddy.
The horse is one important piece of the story, but I think you're touching on another thing that's really important that many women will resonate with, and you're talking about a marriage that wasn't going so well, and I think that we see this kind of tension a lot between kind of what's our social obligation, what's our familial obligation around perhaps marriage or staying because it's easier, and then how do we kind of balance that out with our personal desire and kind of what our soul is leading us to do? I'm wondering if you could talk about maybe your own journey with kind of uncovering that or what the process of writing it out did for you and what kind of advice you might offer to other women who might go to a book like yours to find some clarity around this big issue.
It's really a difficult journey when you're in a relationship that just isn't feeding your soul. And, you know, I didn't have children, so that was made it a little bit easier in a way for me. But whether you have children or not, if you're in a marriage that is just holding you back or cramping your growth, I don't think there's one way to solve it. But I think looking at it clearly and saying, this isn't working and I need to do something about it. I did all the usual things that people do. I went to therapy. You know, I went to therapy once, I think, so that didn't really work. And, you know, I talked to my friends, and I did all the things that you ordinarily do when you're trying to figure out what are my possibilities here. And along the way, I got some bad advice from some friends. They said, well, you know, stay with him. Don't worry. You'll be fine. And that was really the wrong advice. And I think you have to look deep inside yourself, and it's not easy. And not everyone will come up to the same decision that I did. I decided finally that if I wanted to be a whole person, I had to leave this marriage. not everybody will come to that decision. To be clear, the marriage I was in was not a physically abusive marriage, and I think that that's a dangerous situation. And if you're in that situation, my best advice would be get out as soon as you can. And I know that that's not that easy either. But for me, writing about the experience, just really kind of thinking as deeply as I could about what I was doing, why I was where I was, how I'd gotten there, and shedding the guilt along the way of, you know, rats, I was in this marriage, I committed to it, now I don't want to be in it. And eventually just realizing I can't feel guilty about that. I need to do what's right, because you only really get one life on this planet. So it sometimes takes a lot of courage to admit that you made a mistake and move forward.
Right, or to acknowledge that you've changed in this thing that earlier decision no longer serves you. And I think you've touched on something really big. You've talked about, sounds like it was an emotionally abusive relationship. There might just be nothing. There might be no emotional support or physical abuse. Like, that's a whole other thing. Whatever the situation is, making any kind of change is always pretty difficult for people. And so for you, how does the horse kind of serve you in navigating this journey?
I got the horse 5 years before my marriage ended, and we had been, by that point, I think, married 2/3 of the way through the marriage, although, of course, I didn't know that at the time. Being with the horse changed me totally. I had the horse in various stables, then I had him at home, and working with a horse is really time-consuming, not just riding, but because so many places that I kept him, I was the one who was in charge of, you know, taking care of his stall, making sure he was fed, grooming him, all that kind of stuff. I was away from home a lot, and I suddenly began to realize that I really liked being away from home. And not only that, but I liked this new person that was evolving. I was becoming physically stronger, a lot more confident. I think it was a gradual evolution, and at no point did I say, I have a horse, therefore I should leave my marriage. It's not that, you know, simple, obviously. But I do remember at one point I was boarding my horse at a stable where a lot of college students boarded. And I was kind of grumbling about, well, my husband this, my husband that. And this one very wise college student looked at me and she said, horses and divorces. And I was like, what? And she turned out her mom was a divorce attorney, and many of her clients were women of a certain age, 40s or so, who'd discovered horses and then suddenly discovered, oh, wait, there's more to life than I realized. And, oh, wait, I don't think I want to be with this man that I've grown away from now. And so that was the funny part of it. But of course, it's not ever really funny when you're going through it. It's very kind of, it's very trying. Being with the horse too, for me, was also very, a kind of spiritual experience in a way. I used to go for trail rides by myself with him a lot. And it was just the kind of experience where there's no words. I wasn't talking to the horse, although occasionally I did sing to him rather badly. We would be walking through the woods or trotting or cantering through the woods. And it's just this communication of being to being. And I think that really opened up a new way of understanding the world for me that I wasn't feeling at all in my marriage and knew that I wanted to feel in a relationship and a relationship with someone who was probably human as well as someone who was my horse. So it was a way of kind of saying, oh, there's another way of being.
That's beautiful. Of course, you are writing this because you had this intense experience. You carry your notebook with you all the time, and you're kind of making sense out of life as you go. But when you were writing your book, who was the audience you had in mind?
My first book, Rose City, which was about growing roses and some other things, I remember my publisher at the time saying, when you're writing, you should write to your ideal reader. She said, whoever that is, whether it's a real person or somebody invented, write to your ideal reader. You know, imagine who this person is. If it's real, that's great. If it's not, you know, really make this person a character that you're writing to. And so when I was writing Still Life, I was doing that. I was thinking, well, who is my ideal reader for this? And frankly, it wasn't someone who was stuck in a marriage. It was someone who was young and, you know, maybe early 20s and thinking about life and, you know, moving forward into what their dreams and aspirations might be. And honestly, the person I was writing to is one of the people in the book. Her name is Blair, and she's a fantastic writer. And she's also someone who really just doggedly follows her dreams. And I thought, that's the person I want to write to. this book is for that person to encourage them to keep going forward, to follow your dreams, and be the best version of yourself that you can possibly be. So that's who I was writing to.
I like that. That's really beautiful. Can you mention the first book that you wrote as well?
My first book is called Rose City, A Memoir of Work. It's about when I moved from Massachusetts, where I'm from, to East Central Indiana and took a job in a rose growing greenhouse. And this was in 1992. It was before NAFTA, and it was when the city I was living in, Richmond, Indiana, was still called the Rose City, and that was one of its biggest markets or outputs or whatever you call it. And so I worked in this rose greenhouse. I worked with people who were from Appalachia, who were doing really difficult job of cutting roses and spraying them with chemicals. And I was really moved by these people. I thought they're strong and they're generous, and yes, they're uneducated, and yes, they're kind of from the back hills or wherever. But I learned a lot from working with those people, and I think that was another life-changing experience that just had to become a book. So that's what I did. I wrote a book.
That's fantastic. And I have a couple closing questions that I want to ask you about still life as well. But before I go there, I want to know what you're working on right now.
Right now, I am working on a book about five generations of women in my family. The first generation is in the mid-late 1800s. My great-great-grandmother was wife of a whale ship captain. And she and her husband sailed around the world for 4.5 years hunting whales, or he was hunting whales, she was just with him. And they took one of their children along, had another child while they were gone, wrote copious amounts of letters home, all of which I've read. Their story is just fascinating to me. And then the generations of women that follow them and how they all try in some ways to live up to this kind of almost mythic stature of this woman in the late 1800s who was so incredibly brave, and kind of in the sort of class issues that the whale ship captain was from Nantucket. And so the class issues that eventually, through the generations, it seems like this trying to live up to and the classism kind of corrodes how these women interact with each other. And it's just fascinating to me. And there's also cool stuff like poisonings and a suicide and potential, various shady things that happen along the way, even though these women really think of themselves as, upper class and blue bloods and all that kind of stuff. They lead lives of mystery and intrigue and violence. So I'm having a lot of fun writing this and learning a lot about my family and, by extension, about myself as well.
I had to ask because I had a feeling you had another project in the works. That's what writers do. And I wanted to just talk a little bit more about your process as a writer before we conclude. One thing that I was really struck by when you spoke during my residency last summer at Augsburg, I think that you shared that you had maybe received somewhere around 57 rejection letters for this book before you. Is that right?
That's right.
What did you do to really keep at it, and what kept you believing in the story in the face of a lot of rejection?
I hate getting rejected as much as anybody else. I actually, this week, I've got two rejections that I'm still padding about it. But at the same time, I know that if I really believe in a project, I have enough confidence in myself as a writer that I know that my own belief is warranted. But when I was starting out, I remember just saying to myself, I have written this essay or story or whatever, and I think it's pretty good. And my faithful writer friends that I've shown it to think the same, so I'm going to send it out as many times as I have to until it gets published. So you write the good thing, you send it out, you don't even think about it anymore. You work on the next thing, you send it out. And I don't like getting rejected. I really don't. And often rejections come with absolutely no feedback. Nobody gives you any idea of why you've been rejected. So you just kind of think, oh, now what? Fortunately, with Still Life, which did get rejected 57 times, a couple of times I wheedled advice out of the agents or editors or publishers or whoever had rejected it. Just saying, could you give me a little feedback? And Sometimes they did, and when they did, it was helpful, and I thought, oh, you know what, you're right. And so I think when you get rejected, you can pout, but you also have to have enough humility to think there's a reason it was rejected. And maybe the reason is just simply, you know, not right for us, which you hear a lot. But maybe there's something that there's a little bit of a flaw in your manuscript, and you can go look at that. So I try to ask for feedback as much as I can. You won't always get it, but when you do, pay attention to it, and then go back, and if you believe in your manuscript, keep what you believe in, and then tinker with the things that maybe need some work, and just keep sending it out. That's really the only thing to do.
What would you say is the most important lesson you learned on your journey of writing this particular book? This book represents many things to you. There's like this huge element of resiliency, getting 57 rejection letters before you find the right home for it. So there's something there about keeping on, keeping on. And then there's also the big life lessons about navigating, you know, your way out of a marriage that wasn't suiting you anymore. So if you had to think about kind of the most important lessons you've learned on each of those fronts from this journey, what would they be?
I really loved that horse. I was more devastated. This is, horse people will understand this, animal people will understand this. I was more devastated by his death than I was the death of my parents. When you love someone that much, it's not just a one-time thing. And that's what I realized most writing this book, is that if you have a capacity for great love, if that great love goes away, however that happens, you still have the capacity for great love. And so that kind of meant to me, you know, I'm going to be okay, because I apparently need to have great love in my life. So working on the book taught me that, and it opened me up to a lot of more profound, deep relationships with my women friends at the same time. And especially my women writer friends, where we talked about my work, we talked about their work, and the importance of relationships in any life really came home to me, how important it is. Animal relationships. I have now, my husband and I, Kurt, who's in the book, we have 4 horses and 5 dogs, and the horse that I have that I got after Buddy died will be turning 20 tomorrow, and that's a pretty good age for a horse. But I know he's not going to live another 20 years. He just isn't. And so I think one of the things that you sign on to when you love something is the inevitability of loss. But that loss makes me pay closer attention and be more aware and more grateful for the time that you have.
That is beautiful, and I love that you're talking about it in like an animal context, but I think listeners could pull away from that and think about, oh, this is my, like somebody who's a little bit commitment phobic, or they're afraid to get close to somebody because it might end. Like that really speaks to them, I think, as well. So that's really beautiful. And would that be the biggest thing that you're hoping that readers take away from this book?
Yeah, I'm going to be 60 this summer, unless I live to 120. There are more years behind me than ahead of me. And it's really made me think about how precious our time here is. And every interaction you have with someone, whether it's your devoted husband or your devoted girlfriend or your children or your friends or whatever, you only get to have that particular interaction one time, and then it's gone. That doesn't mean the person's going to be gone, but it means that little piece of time is gone forever. And I think that that's what I would want readers to take away from it, is that all of this is, this being life, and the people and animals and communities that surround us, is really, really precious, and we ought to really value it a lot.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add before we conclude?
Yeah, I think one really validating thing that's happened since the book has come out is that people who have read it and appreciated it, liked it, write to me individually and tell me how much it meant to them. I've actually had one person who said that it changed her life, that she realized she was just kind of going through the motions in a relationship that she was in, and that she wasn't going to do that anymore. So as a writer, wowie zow, that makes me feel pretty good, you know. I feel like I've written something that matters.
It is such a great book with such a wide relatability factor, I feel. I also don't want to end without asking how people could get in touch with you or stay on top of you and your work.
I have a website, and it's jeanharper.org, JEANHARPER.org. And I have a really goofy email. It is writerite, WRITE, at AOL.com.
Jean Harper, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your work.
Thanks so much for doing this.